This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Sonia M., Virginia F., Susan H., and Liz R. For more information on how you can support the podcast, please visit its Patreon page at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now on with the show. Vulture.com has dubbed it the Summer of Scam. With a handful of sisters very much doing it for themselves, I've got your essential long-form, long-cons reading list. Later, we'll take a trip through the Blotter.com's archives with fake Rockefellers, French nationals in over their heads, and other grifty tramps and thieves in the cold case section. Lock down those last fours of your socials. It's The Blotter Presents. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting. Just this chicken again this week as I continue to get organized on the back end. But look out for guests and our formal relaunch coming next week. And if you'd like to support the podcast and the site at the-blotter.com, voting on upcoming content, listening to bonus episodes, even getting a customized recommendations list of true crime properties from yours truly, I would love that. You can find The Blotter's Patreon page at, strangely enough, patreon.com/blotterpresents. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. Thanks for having a look and for listening. Let's get into it. Today in the Most Wanted section, the Summer of Scam. Vulture's Hunter Harris referred to the Summer of Scam in a piece a couple weeks back that linked to the Con Queen of Hollywood piece in the Hollywood Reporter. That is a deep dive by Scott Johnson into the prolific and bold, quote, organization that's been impersonating powerful Hollywood women for over a year. Quote, victims of the elaborate ruse are led to believe they are speaking to powerful female entertainment executives, including billionaire producer and philanthropist Gigi Pritzker, former Paramount head Sherry Lansing, 20th Century Fox CEO Stacey Snyder, and Leslie Linka Glatter, a director and executive producer on shows including Homeland, The Walking Dead, and Mad Men. End quote. The piece goes on, quote, the victims travel to Indonesia on a promise of work and, once there, are asked to hand over relatively modest amounts of money at a time, up to $3,000 in some cases, to help cover expenses for things like car travel, translation, tour guides, and fixers. A designated Indonesian money man arrives on a moped to collect the funds. Needless to say, the promised reimbursements never arrive, end quote. This article is well-written, direct, and it includes a fun ancillary list at the end of notorious Hollywood scams, including David Begelman and the guy who got free dinners out of pretending to be Stanley Kubrick. You can find that on The Hollywood Reporter, and it's called Hunting the Con Queen of Hollywood. This, like everything else I mentioned, will be linked in today's show notes. Of course, the Summer of Scams, we know it, began at New York Magazine, specifically with Anna, quote, Delvey, who's listed in Gabriella Paella's list of six must-know scammers. That's on the cut. Six incredible scammer and grifter stories. And Gabriella, I hope I did not pronounce your last name incorrectly. Gabriella has written a very fun list on its own. But right at the top is, of course, Jessica Pressler's lengthy investigation into Anna's big store con, or big hotel con, come to think of it. The piece is fantastic. I only wish that Pressler had gone into a bit more depth as to how this sort of thing can work at the granular level at restaurants and hotels. Perhaps there is a concern that it might read too much like a how-to. Anyway, this is a classic read in the long-form con coverage genre. How Anna Delvey Tricked New York, and that is on thecut.com or in New York Magazine. Are you wondering how so many people fall for these ladies' BS? I mean, that's part of the appeal of a con story, no? Getting to feel superior to marks who should know better? while almost admiring the chutzpah of the scammers themselves as you think to yourself, perhaps speculatively, how easy it looks. I may as well note here that I fell for one of Manhattan's better-known flim-flammers. This was a couple of decades ago. He was faking an asthma attack, claimed he was late for a something or other he was doing as a PA. He was nearly in tears, and he was wearing a bust T-shirt, which is what got me, let's face it. I gave him $20. He swore up and down that he would mail it back to me. I didn't believe him, but I also didn't think I'd been conned. I just didn't believe him. He tried to hit me again later that year and feigned ignorance when I told him that we had, quote, met before, and my friend Matthew, some of you may remember him as Gustav from Television Without Pity, informed me at some point that Tony is pretty well known, and I think I even read about him in, like, a Voice article on the city's headline Hustlers. This dude is a redhead, looks kind of like Bonaducci. Of course, now I can't find that article, so if any of y'all know what I'm talking about and hunt it up, please hit me with it on our social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. And in the show notes, you will find a link to a Gothamist article in which city dwellers discuss the times that they've been conned or that a con has been attempted on them. In any case, one of Anna, quote, Delvey's victims, Rachel Deloche Williams, bravely put her side of things on the record in a first-person piece for Vanity Fair in a recent issue. It's linked as My Misadventure with the Magician of Manhattan, although in the magazine I do not think it was called that. Regardless, Vanity Fair really knows how to do these crime stories, and Williams and her evident exasperation are very sympathetic. Wrapping it up on the recent scams tip, you can give a listen to Jezebel's Dirtcast, which gets into Delvey and others, including the guy on Queer Eye, who is classified as a con artist because he can't really cook. And that link will also be in our show notes. Okay, so time to look back at stories of grift from all around the world that I have covered on the blotter. There is perhaps no kind of crime story that I like better except for tales of currency forgery, which are few and far between, at least ones that are actually readable. So let's start with Dori Shafrir's Observer story on Carrie Farrell, a.k.a. the hipster grifter. I'd been seeing a lot of references to Carrie lately, but the story is almost 10 years old. Again, here, this story is a bit rushed as to how exactly Carrie Farrell gets the cons to work for her. It's not really clear how the claims of terminal cancer tie into the ongoing con, except perhaps in a Munchausen kind of way. But Shafrir does get excellent non-anodyne quotes from the various marks. A quick Google didn't tell me what is going on with Carrie Farrell right now. The story wrapped up with some kind of extradition order being issued by the state of Utah, or perhaps the city of Salt Lake. But it is unclear where in the world she is now. The real world traveler on this list, of course, is Christian Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, a.k.a. Well, that's a long list, but here's a short list. Mark Seals, the man in the Rockefeller suit, is an outstanding history of Gerhardsreiter's various cons and crimes, but it ends before his murder trial. That is sort of where Walter Kern's Blood Will Out starts. Kern apparently was like social friends with Rockefeller and may have been conned by him in a few small ways. Kern, who may be best known to longtime readers of my other blog, Tomato Nation, as having issued a 0 degrees Kelvin assessment of James Frye's book. The tone, the brisk tone is just about the same in Blood Will Out, and nobody is better at puncturing the bullshit bubble, for lack of a better term, that surrounds Princeton and its sort of cultish sense of self. Kern does not present as necessarily the most likable person in his writings, but other unlikable people are skewered with relish, and it's pretty fun. I will have a review of that one on theblotter.com this week. And you can read my full review of The Man in the Rockefeller Suit on the site anytime you like. I did not review The Woman Who Wasn't There, which is the story of, quote, Tanya Head, a.k.a. the 9/11 faker. This documentary I watched on Netflix. It's no longer available there. You can watch it if you are an Amazon Prime member, and if you're not, I think you can rent it for a couple bucks. Don't be turned off by occasionally twee visuals. Given the subject matter, the only workable alternative, as you'll see once you get into it, it's an extremely solid sit if you like this kind of subject matter. Once again, that's called The Woman Who Wasn't There. I also unearthed in the archives Maureen O'Hagan's piece for the Seattle Times from a few years ago on an identity thief who died before anyone could figure out who she had been before or why she wasn't who she claimed to be. Lori Ruff had taken the identity of a 2-year-old who had perished in a fire years before. That is in the special reports section of the Seattle Times on their website, and it's called My God, That's Kimberly, Online Sleuths Solves Perplexing Mystery of Identity Thief Lori Ruff. Obviously, you're not writing all of that down. Once again, it's in the show notes. And last, but never least, Frédéric Bourdin. No relation. The Imposter is a documentary about Frédéric Bourdin that I have probably watched 5 times now, and here is my review. The Imposter, The Past Isn't Past. Though he emphasized his cunning, he acknowledged what any con man knows but rarely admits. It is not that hard to fool people. People have basic expectations of others' behavior and are rarely on guard for someone to subvert them. By playing on some primal need, vanity, greed, loneliness, men like Bourdin make their mark further suspend disbelief. As a result, most cons are filled with logical inconsistencies, even absurdities, which seem humiliatingly obvious after the fact. End quote. That is from David Grant's outstanding piece on Bourdin, The Chameleon, from The New Yorker's 11 August issue from 2008. Definitely worth a read as well. I will link that. Sing it with me if you know the words in the show notes. The crime. Serial chameleon Frédéric Bourdin inhabits the identity of a missing Texan kid in 1997. Busted again after a few months, he claims that he's hardly the biggest criminal in the situation. The story. I've always found it fascinating, the willingness of the average person to trust others. It's partly neurobiology, no doubt, the same way the optic nerve will complete visual patterns with parts missing. It's one way in which we order the world, assuming that most things are as they appear. When I worked as a records clerk, chasing down current addresses and career information for the alumni office, I saw a variation on it every day. That if you act as though you have the right to information, you will usually get that information, no questions asked. People want you to know things, want you to know them. It's a little flower of hope that this is, and is usually, true. But now and then a weed gets a foothold, and that's a subset of true crime that fascinates me. The identity con, I suppose you might call it. Sometimes, as in the case of James Hogue, it's identity creation. Other times, it's identity conspiracy, a flim-flam of hope, a case solved. All those Anastasia Romanoffs and Charlie Lindberghs that used to surface years ago. Recent episodes of American Horror Story cleverly traded on this. Side note here, I wrote this in November of 2012, so I think that was referring to the character played by Franca Potente, who was claiming to be Anne Frank. If I'm incorrect about that, you can correct me on social media. And then you have the outright identity thefts, although it's hard to say what, if anything, is outright about Frederick Bourdin, the subject of Bart Layton's documentary The Imposter. Bourdin, a serial imitator of homeless teens across Europe in the 1990s, stepped into the role of a lifetime and across the line between grifty and monstrous in 1997 when he decided to imitate an American teen who had gone missing 3 years earlier. Or did he? Bourdin imitated Nicholas Barclay, this we know. He's admitted it and was sentenced to 6 years for the various fraudulent activities surrounding it. What's interesting about the case isn't just that Bourdin did it, or how he did it, or that he'd done it so many times before, or that he did it again after the U.S. deported him back to France, although seeing that particular compulsion in action is both disturbing and captivating. It's that Nicholas Barclay's family let him do it, may have wanted him, or someone anyway, to do it. The humiliatingly obvious discrepancies mentioned before that Nicholas's mother and sister almost defiantly refused to see. The obvious dye job, the different eye color, the accent he shouldn't have lost after only 3 years away, and the new one that made no sense. The Peter Straubian abduction tale. At first, seemed like the understandable blindness to the truth of a family desperately hoping to reunite with a lost son and brother. As the facts and months accumulate, though, it starts to seem more like they want the rest of the world to buy their reunion. Like they knew all along he wasn't Nicholas, because they knew all along Nicholas wasn't exactly missing. If Bourdin manipulated Nicholas's family into accepting him wholeheartedly as their own, yes, he's a monster. But if they knew from the get that he was a French man with an agenda, it's far less clear who the monster is, or if there's just one of them. This case first came to my attention in the excellent Grand piece linked above, which goes into more detail than the film about the murky family connections, as well as Bourdin's activities prior to 1997. And I'd recommend pairing them. The Imposter is prosaic on the filmmaking level, but more recent, and among the Clue Channel-esque reenactments, you'll find story just in the faces of Bourdin and Nicholas's family. You could call Layton's pointed holds at the end of interview segments tricksy, but I thought it was effective. The media complement each other and the story wonderfully. Next time on The Blotter Presents, Kevin Smokler on two arts history podcasts that put the pop, as in getting popped, back in pop culture. We'll be discussing You Must Remember This's most recent season, as well as the first season of Cocaine and Rhinestones from last year. Got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media, Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. Email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. Comment on the content at the-blotter.com, or become an official Blotter tipster at the Blotter's Patreon page. Once again, that's patreon.com/blotterpresents. To find out what I'm reading, friend me on Goodreads at Sarah D. Bunting. To advertise on the podcast, email me, bunting@the-blotter.com. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I will get through this 15-hour Patty Hearst audiobook before the library sends a searching party. Talk to you next time.